There are times during surgery when you discover a way to make things easier or more efficient. Sometimes there are through our own quicksand moments. Others are surgical gems gifted to us by our mentors and peers. This is OQC Eureka Moments with Drs. Nicole Fram and Elizabeth Yu, where we learn how to pivot, reflect, and evolve as surgeons.
Welcome, everyone, to the fourth episode of Ophthalmology Quicksand Chronicles Eureka Moments. It's actually the new year. It's Rosh Hashanah and specifically Yom Kippur. And I just have to say, L'chaim, I practiced that. I wanted to really practice that.
That was amazing. That was amazing.
I did. Like, Nicole, how'd I do?
You know, Dr. Liz, Fram. I hope you have a happy new year and an easy fast.
Oh, my God. Oh, shoot. Oh, man.
You already how long eat? Oh, God.
Oh, no. I mean, no, just my monster. Is that okay?
It doesn't count.
Oh, okay, good. We are your hosts. I'm Elizabeth Yu.
And I'm Nicole Fram. And we're so excited to continue season 3, which will focus on those moments that we take away from surgery that are difficult, and then we turn into these eureka moments to bring us out of the dark and into an easy day in the OR.
And as we all know, there's always this point in surgery where we discover a way to make things easier or more efficient. And we want to be able to share these techniques with you that we've learned either from just experiences or what mentors have shared with us that helped us to speed that learning curve and pass down those surgical gems. I've learned great things from our guest today, which I'll mention later, that have been gifted to us by our mentors and our peers whom we truly respect and love.
And it's having this kind of institutional knowledge or these memories of these surgical gems in the middle of a difficult situation that allows us to shift from plan A to plan Z in 2 seconds so that you're going to have a nice, smooth outcome.
As a reminder, this season will be available through video and audio podcasts, so you can listen or watch on your favorite platform and watch on YouTube. At the end of this podcast, we would love for you to fill out a short survey in the description below to help us understand what you find valuable, what content you'd like to see, or anything else that would help to improve or what you would like to see more of, so we can integrate this into future episodes.
So Liz, before we get into our amazing expert surgeon and Eureka moment, do you know who the sponsor is?
I kind of do, because we both love them. Tell us who our sponsor
is. Do it. Here we go. It is LENSAR, Ally Adaptive Cataract Treatment System. It is our next generation femtosecond laser. We just acquired this year, and it's a game changer. People are fighting over the laser room. And I have to learn how to play nice in the sandbox because everybody wants to use it. It's the industry's first dual pulse laser. Ally is 2 times faster in the lens and 4 times faster in the cornea, and allows for precise, efficient, tissue-specific cutting and fragmentation. It's a very small footprint, and it's a retractable laser head. It enables it to fit in almost any OR and allows for sterile flax procedure, which is very different than some of the other femtosecond laser platforms. It has incredible diagnostics. You take a reference image from your biometry, it goes right in. It has iris registration, so you know exactly where your steep axis is. And then it puts these tabs on the capsulorhexis so that you can know where the steep axis is, because there can be up to 5 degrees of cyclotorsion during your femtosecond laser procedure, which we know, depending on the power of the toric lens, can really decrease its efficacy. So Liz, tell me, what are your thoughts about the LENSAR? I know I sound really excited, but you can tell when I actually use a technology.
I absolutely think it is the premier, well, one, femtosecond laser system, but two, efficiency-wise, it is unbelievable. So having had used femtosecond lasers for the last 10 years, and now having had used different types of femtosecond lasers, the ability to not need to manually mark patients, to have an open box system that can use different types of diagnostics, whether it's like the Cassini or the Pentacam, that directly inputs the iris registration in order to actually account for exactly what the patient's steep meridian is. So then to have the either markings onto the lens itself on the capsule or onto the cornea with little 5 to 7 degree tabs if you choose to do it onto cornea, or to have the femto LRIs if the sill is low. That combination just makes it so much easier. And it really has, and Denise Visco has shown with her studies that it does elevate and improve our outcomes. And postoperatively, it's so great because then if I find that there is sill, or and I want to see, well, is
Did
it a
it rotate?
malrotation?
Yeah,
I can just look for the tabs. It's
right there.
amazing.
Yeah,
It's so great. So I love it.
for those real fast surgeons like Liz and those people that do 100 cases a day like Liz, it's fast. So the argument that femtosecond laser is slowing me down, you can do a treatment in under a minute, and these people that are super high volume can really stay on pace. So thank you so much to Lenzar for supporting the podcast and bringing us great technology.
And it allows us to have our superstar surgeons to be guests on Eureka Moments. And today, our wonderful guest is Dr. Julie Schallhorn. Yay! Welcome, Dr. Schallhorn.
Thanks so much, guys, for having me.
Oh, Dr. Schallhorn has taught me. I mean, it's amazing. So I have worked with Dr. Schallhorn, well, we all have, since she was part of the Young Eye Surgeons Clinical Committee and then coming on to the Cornea Clinical Committee with ASCRS. But there are many gems that she has taught me. Not only is she such a gifted surgeon and she's a clinician scientist, but she's an amazing cornea specialist and an associate director of the ophthalmic residency program at UC San Francisco. She organizes classroom and research curricula for residents. Her research focuses on cornea and refractive surgeries with a special interest in anterior segment imaging and its potential to improve and optimize disease diagnosis and refractive outcomes. And she has, an extensive list of published works and holds 8 professional society memberships. And one gem that I've learned from her recently is, especially when we're thinking of contact lens warpage versus looking for keratoconus and using anterior segment imaging for that anterior segment OCG, great Eureka moment, you'll see epithelial hypertrophy over the area of where you're thinking would be the potential cone if it is due to contact lens warpage versus it would be thin if it is due to keratoconus. And that is a great pearl that Julie Schallhorn published more recently. So she is filled with Eureka moments. So Dr. Schallhorn today is going to be sharing surgical Eureka moment pearls with us.
So thanks, Liz. Julie, we're so excited to have you here, or Dr. Schallhorn, I should say. One of the things that I love about you is how precise you are and your grace when you teach and how clear you are. And I cannot wait to hear how you share this moment with us. We just want to remind everyone that this is a podcast about how we discover ways to make things easier or more efficient as surgeons so that we can allow you to skip that part of the learning curve. And that's what Eureka Moments is about. So, Julie, please share your Eureka moment with us.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. Thanks for the kind words and for having me. Okay. So today I am going to share, here's my financial disclosures, a case with you that I've been following for a number of years. And it's, there are cases that just end up in large academic systems. And this is very much one of those cases. So This is a guy. He's a farmer. He actually is a farmer in Northern California. He's out on a horse, literally like all day long in the fields with like his cows. And he's been exposed to a lot of sun. In 2010, he has a left forehead basal cell carcinoma that has many, many recurrences, and he ends up getting incinerated in his left orbit. So he is unfortunately monocular. And then 8 years later, it recurs and it invades his right orbit. He's got, you know, cranial nerve, you know, V1, V3 involvement, and he gets definitive radiation to the right orbit. But that unfortunately gives him total hypesthesia of the right cornea, and it takes out his orbicularis. So he can't blink. He's got a neurotrophic keratitis. He has also got a superior branch, the cranial nerve third palsy. So he's got pretty bad ptosis in his only eye. So our plastics people go and they put in a sling, but unfortunately then he can't close his eye at all. So he gets a bad corneal ulcer. This is when he becomes my patient, and he gets a corneal scar. And, you know, we rehabilitate his ocular surface. I'm feeling good about it. He's actually seeing pretty darn good. But then in 2022, his best corrected acuity drops from 2060 to 2250. And he comes in and I'm just like, oh geez, what's happening? What's going on? And, you know, I look at him and thank God he has a cataract. I can take care of that. I am a cataract surgeon. I can make him see better. There's like nothing I love seeing more when somebody has like bad vision than a cataract. Cause that is, you know, we can take care of that, but you can see now he's got pretty extensive inferior corneal scarring from this ulcer that he had. He doesn't dilate great and, you know, he doesn't blink. So this is his topography. This is basically meaningless because his corneal surface is so irregular. You know, what Ks are am I going to use? Which IOL am I going to put in? And, you know, for cases like this, when you have so much extensive corneal scarring that you can't even get a good keratometry reading, you know, you got to think about what's going to give them the best vision after surgery. This guy already wears a scleral lens. He's going to stay in a scleral lens after surgery. So we're going to try and do our best for our IOL targeting, but know that we can always correct that residual refractive error with the scleral lens afterwards. Because of that, we definitely want to do a monofocal lens, non-toric lens, because he's going to go back into that scleral lens. And if you do have a good idea, a good sense of refractive targeting for patients like that, I always like to give them a little bit of myopia afterwards so that they can continue to be able to see to put in their scleral lens. Because if you target them in distance, you know, they still can't see very well because of, you know, their corneal scar, and they, you know, then they really can't see to put in their scleral lens. So I target those people for a little bit of myopia. So this guy's going to
so
get a
smart. That's great pearl.
I got to say that's not my idea. I learned that from Deborah Jacobs, actually.
Yeah.
And she said that. I was like, oh my God, yes, that is exactly the right answer. So thanks, Deborah Jacobs.
That's, well, it's just common sense, right? It's just common sense.
Totally, totally is. Yeah. Leave them so to be able to do the thing that they need to see. So, you know, so here we are during surgery. And this scar is inferior. You can see I'm kind of sitting slightly supratemporally. And I don't want to take up a lot of my clear cornea that I can see with a clear corneal incision. So I'm going to make a scleral tunnel in this case. I don't love scleral tunnels. I don't do them super frequently. But I don't really want to use any real estate that I can, because my view is already so limited. So I'm going to do a fairly short scleral tunnel. And when you've got a corneal scar, you got to use all the tricks and tools possible available to you. So definitely try pin blue. And I'm not even going to put in iris retractors for this because I can't even see inferiorly. So there's no reason to make his iris bigger inferiorly if I can't see. The other thing is, when you're phacoing corneal scars, operate where you can see. So I am staying in this like superior supranasal quadrant where I actually have a view. I'm not going to go anywhere else. And I'm just going to keep all the lens pieces right there where I can see them. When you have a corneal scar, it's hard to see where, you know, to your rexus, it's hard to see where the lens is going to sit. So in these cases, I really like putting in three-piece lenses just in case one of the haptics ends up in the sulcus. That way, you know, you're not going to give somebody UGG. You're not going to have to go in and do an IOL exchange when you already can't see. And then because he's going to go back into a scleral lens pretty rapidly, you know, within a week, I'm going to put in a corneal suture here just to make sure that, you know, he doesn't accidentally burp his wound. So, you know, going with cases like this, you know, this is what I think, you know, visibility is poor. Use whatever you can to make your life easier. If it's hooks, try pan blue. Sometimes I'll use a light pipe externally on the cornea. Improve your view. You know, scars have a lot of high irregular cylinder. You got to have a post-op plan for management. You know, if they're going to be in a scleral, target near, don't never use a toric if they're going back into a scleral, because that just makes the fit more difficult. So you've got to do a bi-toric fit. And if you can't really see very well, put in a three-piece lens. You don't want to accidentally give somebody UGG by putting a lens in a sulcus. So those are my pearls, my aha moments, at least with this case. And that's what I got.
That was awesome. I have a quick question. So like, you know, in this case, right, you've got this scar, which we knew this scar was from the exposure, but if it wasn't as obvious that this is that, I mean, because that could look like CIN, right? Especially given the history. And if you had not followed the patient as long as you did, and this is, you know, you're getting these kind of tougher cases, and there is this carcinoma history. You know, I know that, again, imaging can be very helpful there. What kind of, and I love that this is where anterior segment OCT, again, can be helpful. How can you use anterior segment OCT? What pearl can you use there?
Yeah, so this is really drawing off of Carol Karp at Bascom's work, and she's done such a nice job looking at, you know, anterior segment OCT plasms. And with that, you know, you want to get a you know, do a line scan transitioning from the normal cornea into the lesion of interest. And you can actually see a change in the reflectance of the epithelium if it is an ocular surface neoplasm. Whereas if it's not a neoplasm, you can actually just see that clear, continuous normal corneal epithelium going over the scar. You know, I wish I had some images for this case to show you. I didn't, because I didn't know CT, having watched the scar kind of evolve over time. But I use that all the time. You know, I'm actually out here right now at our VA hospital. There's so many vets had just tons of sun exposure. Ocular surface neoplasia is super common. And if you're looking at a thing, you're like, is that a pterygium? Or is that, you know, is that something a little bit more nefarious? Using anterior segment OCT to look at that epithelial transition zone between the lesion and the normal cornea, it can be extremely helpful.
That's awesome. I use that all the time, but in this case, we knew it was exposure and pannus and all of those things. Let's break it down a little more, because you made that look so easy, but there's a lot of stuff going into it. So you did a beautiful job talking about the calculations. Let's talk about anesthesia. It's a monocular patient. You know, it's going to be a hard case. Did you block?
Yeah, so it's a really, really good question. You know, so when it's not specifically a monocular patient and I think they need a block, I will block them, but I use lidocaine instead of lidocaine plus bupivacaine. Lidocaine has a duration of action of roughly 20 to 30 minutes. So what you can do is you can give them a lidocaine block, you know, put a patch on them for the first, you know, 10, 20 minutes in recovery, and then just have them take the patch off and put
it's not going to get diplopia. Yeah. So the other thing that I learned, you know, from Frank Price in the early DSEC days, but also Paul Singh has talked about this, where his dad taught him this, may he rest in peace, 6-0 silk on a G6 needle, right, as traction sutures to kind of keep control of what's going on. I was really appreciative of the million Steri-Strips that you put around the eyelashes. I think that my mentor and partner, who has a video of him draping for 45 minutes back in the day, would really, I know he already loves you, Sam Maskett, but this is really going to make him, like, you're the favorite now. Like, that's it. You're it. That's straight up like OCD beyond. So these are the little things that I'm watching that are actually really important. Infection is out of the question in this guy, right? In any patient, right? But this is, so that was really done well. So your draping was incredible. Turning off, you know, at least the Lumera, the Zeiss Lumera has three lights, right? So there's two coaxial, which are coming out of your oculars, and then there's a tangential light. If you turn off the tangential and you play with the lighting, or as you mentioned, turn off the microscope and just use a light pipe, those are ways that you can see through a cloudy cornea. And then, you know, when I first saw it, I said, why, what does everybody have against hooks, iris hooks? But you made a really good point. Like, you can't go where you can't see. And when you start trying to go into thin and disrupted normal collagen of the cornea, you are going to get a leak that you've never seen in your lifetime and never be able to close. Ask me how I know. So I really understand now why you didn't put hooks in. Maybe you could have put one under your incision when you were inserting, But besides that, I mean, I really think that the decision making in this case, you know, was beautiful. And I just wanted to point out those little other pearls that you had there.
I totally, oh, that's the other thing. And the draping, absolutely. And making wounds in scar tissue. I mean, whenever I do a pre-op exam in scar tissue, I'm always really trying to see how much thinning there is in the area, of course, because obviously thinning is a major issue because that conjunctivalization often happens not only from exposure, but that's the body's response to protect something happening, which oftentimes is thinning, delin, et cetera, right? Which is not uncommon. But at the time of surgery, when you go in and make a wound, that like splays open into like this circular wound that wants to just leak. So to, you know, when, you know, to anyone who was watching this Dr. Schallhorn surgery, she did not make a clear corneal wound, as she mentioned, and she really did not make a paracentesis at all
anywhere else in any area.
Yeah. That was not in with clear, healthy cornea. So that's also another great point. And then of course, it's always a balance of, you know, is there enough clear cornea that I feel that I could safely do this surgery? Or do we need to at least consider, you know, because a lot of times you can do a superficial keratectomy a little bit and lift some of it off and even not where you're doing a full superficial keratectomy because some of it is tectonic, but enough that you need to clear and see what you need to do for the cataract surgery. But it has to be done carefully because once you do that, you either let that heal, but there could be limbal stem cell issues. Or if you do it at the time of surgery, you've got about 10 or 15 minutes of clarity before things start to get real cloudy on you.
That's such a great point, Liz. You know, I'm a big fan of doing a superficial keratectomy when you need to be able to see, you know, either during a cloudy cornea where you're doing an endothelial keratoplasty or, you know, in a case like this, you know, to be able to get to the cataract. Because a lot of times you look and you're like, well, what's the point of doing a cataract if somebody's got this pannus or, you know, this irregularity in the surface? And, you know, a lot of times it's not the pannus that's or the opacity that's the issue so much. It's the irregularity
that's the irregular astigmatism.
And if you can just remove that, get the cataract out, even if they have regrowth of that pannus, it will thin out over time. And they can actually get really good usable function.
Shockingly.
With an RGP or scleral lens. So,
and Liz, you brought it full circle because an anterior segment OCT will let you know what's going on underneath there. So you didn't realize you did that, but you did that. So now we talked about pre-op and draping and surgery, and maybe you could have moved superiorly if you needed that extra para and did a scleral tunnel superiorly. You had some landscape there. Now let's go into post-op. Like, do you put an amniotic membrane on? Well, no, because you got to see. Did you think about doing a tarsorrhaphy? The suture was genius, right? Tell me about post-op drops. Like, how did you manage that?
Yeah. So, you know, he already had this patient, which you couldn't see, he already had a pretty substantial tarsorrhaphian, which was kind of drug over to the side by those steri-strips. You know, my goal for him and my goal for people with, you know, really he has very bad exposure keratopathy because he doesn't have a blink and he's neurotrophic. So my goal for him was to basically get him back into the scleral lens as soon as possible.
Right.
You know, I'm going to get more rapid healing with the scleral tunnel because there's a nice vascular supply to it. It's going to be less likely to burp with the insertion and the removal of the scleral lens. So patients like that, I usually have them stay out of the lens for a week just because I don't want that suction trauma on the wound. I don't want them burping the wound. After a week, I have them go back into their lens. You know, for him and for a lot of patients with compromised ocular surfaces, I've been switching to dropless surgery, you know, doing intracameral antibiotics, especially for steroids, and then some type of injectable steroid, either, you know, an Ozurdex to the pars plana or, you know, periocular triamcinolone. You know, we haven't been able to get Dextenza at UCSF, but that's also another option. But, you know, because I don't, you know, we can give a preservative, moxifloxacin is preservative free by nature, and it's really well tolerated on the ocular surface. So I don't mind giving people moxifloxacin, but steroids are two things. They slow down epithelial healing and they're preserved, or unless you're getting a specific, you know, preservative free preparation. And I just don't want that extra trauma on a surface that's already compromised.
The other thing that's so great, the other thing about preservative free, I always want them in a preservative in that first week or dropless, because if they're not refrigerating it, there's all kinds of things that grow in there, and they have a denuded epithelium, and now you gave them something that has fungus in it, potentially no good. So at least in that first week when the epithelium's healing, I fully agree with that. So Julie, thank you so much for sharing this incredible case with us that I know I'm going to take with me to the OR next week. Do you have any other gems or pearls you want to share with us for the listeners and viewers?
You know, I think just think about, you know, getting these patients, you know, treating their ocular surface right and doing the thing that's going to enable them to have the best vision, you know, in terms of lens targeting. So thanks so much.
Great. So thank you all for listening to this episode of OQC Eureka Moments. We hope that sharing these techniques will speed that learning curve, pass down gems that have been gifted to us by our mentors.
And please remember to email quicksandchronicles@ascrs.org with any questions and feedback or comments. And don't forget to fill out the brief survey below.
And remember, every time you think you have the eyeball figured out, it's going to humble you.
But we do hope that these collective experiences will help us all develop more grace under pressure. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of OQC Eureka Moments with Drs. Nicole Fram and Elizabeth Yu. Hindsight really is 2020.